All right, Elliot, a couple of things. One left over from last week's podcast. Actually, two things left over from last week's podcast. One of them involves fact-checking. Maybe we'll start with that before we get to Karen Douglas's tweet.
I don't believe in this, but okay.
Well, I know. Well, here's the thing, and maybe this says more about us. Maybe it says more about our listeners, but we talked a lot in the last couple of weeks on the podcast about fact-checkers.
Yeah.
And we have them, and they come out. But I don't know whether to be disappointed about this or inspired about the intellectual level of our listeners.
Okay.
So I made two mistakes last week.
Okay.
Two very specific mistakes, right around the same time as well. One of them, when you referenced TPP, and I said, oh, Trans-Pacific Protocol. It's not true. It's Trans-Pacific Partnership.
And it sounds like they've got a deal.
And I heard about it on Twitter. Like right away, like tweet, and they're still coming in. For people to listen to the podcast a few days after, hey, dumb, it's Trans-Pacific Partnership. Okay? Mm-hmm. Park that for a second.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, you know, sort of a glancing comment that I made about you turning off your phone. And I said, oh, you're not the guy that leaves his phone on just because it's 2 o'clock in the morning and, you know, St. Louis and San Jose have just done a Shattenkirk deal. And you went on to talk about how you leave it on, but you turn the ringer off.
Yeah.
The Shattenkirk deal wasn't with San Jose. It was with St. Louis.
Well, you know what? You know what you're talking
about? With Colorado, and not one person corrected me on it.
No,
so I'm disappointed, everybody, that no one corrected me on that.
Well, here's the thing that, and first of all, I have learned that if you make even the slightest mistake, somebody's going to catch it. But also, the reason you could have been thinking about San Jose and Shattenkirk is because the draft where Timo Meier went 9th overall, San Jose and St. Louis had a deal where it was Shattenkirk and Oshie were going from the Blues to the Sharks for the 9th overall pick and somebody.
Who did they want? Do you know?
I don't know who the player was. I'm trying to remember. I don't remember who the draft pick was. And I'm trying to remember who the San Jose player was. Was a fairly prominent player. I'll remember it. But that was a deal that was on the table. And the story I've been told is that the Blues thought they had a deal, and at the last second, Doug Wilson said no because he wanted to pick Timo Meier.
You're trying to give me a graceful landing spot here, but it's not true. I wasn't thinking about that.
Oh, come on. Take the out, man.
You know what, though? I am fascinated by, and again, we'll get into this idea of the greatest trades that never happened, and specifically at the draft, teams trying to jump in at a certain point. Like, I had someone a few weeks ago talk to me about the Austin Matthews draft.
Yep.
And how the New York Rangers either were close to a deal or had a deal with the Edmonton Oilers for the 4th overall pick. That all went away after Pierre-Luc Dubois went 3rd to Columbus. Everyone figured Jesse Puljujärvi was going to go 3rd, and that would leave 4 open for the Oilers to make their pick. The Rangers really wanted Clayton Keller.
Yep.
Like, really wanted Clayton Keller, and were pushing hard to get that 4th overall pick, figuring, hey, that's going to be safe. We can get Keller there. I mean, I'm always curious as well about, you know, teams and the decisions they make on players and why they take guys. Because usually it comes down to, when you're at the draft table, it'll come down to two players. And obviously it's just the one that gets selected. But there's always a debate, okay, we're going to whittle this down. Who are our guys at this spot? And I know that the Oilers always get, you know, slaughtered about the Matthew Barzal trade in 16 and 33 going for Griffin Reinhardt. And Oilers could have taken Matthew Barzal. The belief was, at that point, the Oilers, if they had kept the pick, would have taken Joel Eriksson Ek, who ended up going to Minnesota. The other one, and he's injured right now with the heart ablation surgery, Charlie McAvoy. When he went to the Boston Bruins, the decision that the Bruins had there and the conversation was, do we take Charlie McAvoy or do we take Dante Fabro? Those are the two that it came down to. See, I think there's a great book in The Greatest Trades That Never Happened and Who Are You Going to Take? And what the decision comes down to. Always interested in making that alternative universe for the NHL because everything, you know, flips so quickly. Eric Lindros has his jersey retired, and cheekily, a number of people made this point. You know, Colorado should retire his jersey as well because, A, it got him Forsberg. Tebow was part of that trade as well, and they turned that into Patrick Waugh. So if you want to be a snot and you're Colorado, retire 88 as well because he gave you two Stanley Cups by way of trades.
Here's the other ones. That draft, Calgary would have gone 3rd overall, Columbus would have gone 4th, and Edmonton 6th. That's where they all would have shaken out. And somebody did confirm to me they were talking about that.
Mm-hmm.
And the draft would have gone Matthews, Toronto, Laine, Winnipeg, Puljujärvi, Calgary, Dubois, Columbus, Ualevi, Vancouver, and either Sergachev or Kachuk to Edmonton, more likely Sergachev.
Interesting.
Now, the other thing, too, is that, and Vancouver has confirmed this to me, there was a chance the Canucks were going to get P.K. Subban that night. But the problem was that Pierre-Luc Dubois was not going to fall to Vancouver's pick because Montreal knew Columbus was taking him. If Montreal believed that Dubois was going to be available at 5, P.K. Subban could have been a Vancouver Canuck.
I remember talking to you the night before. We were both on the floor that day. I was talking to the players, and you were doing trades and talking to general managers. Was that one of the more active Fridays? Even the Thursday was real buzzy.
That was busy.
In Buffalo.
Last year in Chicago, there was about an hour on Friday morning when the Rangers-Arizona trade went down and the Columbus-Chicago trade went down. And Chicago and Arizona made a deal. I was having a meeting with someone at that time, and our meeting got totally blown up.
Yeah.
Because there was also a lot of rumblings about that year, Ryan Nugent-Hopkins for Matt Dumba. And I'm not sure how close that came or didn't come. But that was certainly a crazy year. You know, you talk about drafts that didn't happen. Two of the best stories, well, the three best stories I ever heard was Cliff Fletcher once told me that in Calgary one year, they had a second-round pick, and they were going to take a goalie. And they had three goalies on their list. It was Kay Whitmore, Frank Caprice, and I can't remember who the third goalie is right now. But, and I'm going to look this up, they had three picks until their guy.
Mm-hmm.
So they're like, okay, we've got three picks until us. Goaltending is an organizational need. And we're going to take him. And we're good with that. So 24th overall was New Jersey. They took Sean Burke. Okay, one guy off our list. Don't worry, we've got two more.
Great pick.
Next pick was Vancouver. It wasn't Frank Caprice. It was Troy Gamble.
Oh, yeah.
Vancouver takes Troy Gamble. And they're like, okay, it doesn't matter. We still got one more pick before us. What are the chances we're going to lose all three goalies and three picks right before us? Hartford, Kay Whitmore. So they lose all three of their guys, and Cliff Fletcher says, we look around, what are we going to do? Who's the next guy on our list? Second round pick, 27th overall, Joe Nieuwendyk. And it won them a Stanley Cup, basically. And the next day on the front page of the Calgary Sun was Joe Who.
Joe Who,
yes.
Yeah, from Cornell. Well, you know, similar to that, and I go back to the 2006 draft with this one. And we all can recall Bobby Clark, Philadelphia Flyers, goes up on stage and forgets Claude Giroux's name.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
So someone from L.A. told me this one, that part of the issue was, as you recall, a few weeks previous to the draft, Ron Hextall leaves the Flyers and goes to the Los Angeles Kings. And Bobby Clark loved Trevor Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Right, playing Des Moines, USHL. Loved Trevor Lewis. Saw some Bobby Clark in Trevor Lewis. And this guy is going to be, you know, franchise center for us. This guy's big, rough and tumble, can score, like has some sandpaper in his game. We really want Trevor Lewis. So the draft occurs. Eric Johnson ends up going first overall, had that great World Junior, really bumped him up. Taves goes third. And it comes to 17. Philadelphia's choosing 22nd. And at 17, the LA Kings take Trevor Lewis.
Yep.
And Bob Clark, not too happy about it. He just saw Ron Hextall leave, go to LA. After all the meetings.
Yes.
And take Trevor Lewis. So he's upset. The next player on Philadelphia's list, as I'm told, is Bobby Sanguinetti, the defenseman from Owen Sound. Wants him. One before the Flyers pick, the Rangers.
Yes.
Take Bobby Sanguinetti. So now they've lost Trevor Lewis. They've lost Bob Sanguinetti. And Clarkie is steamed going up on stage to the point where he forgets Claude Giroux's name. And it's very famous. Homer, who are we taking?
Who are we taking?
What's his name? And he says Claude Giroux from Gatineau. And because of those two picks previous, because Los Angeles Kings ended up taking Trevor Lewis and the Rangers took Bobby Sanguinetti. Sanguinetti played in 40 games in the NHL. The Flyers
he's
ended
the Olympics
up
this year, right?
For Bobby Sanguinetti.
Yep.
The Flyers ended up getting the best player.
See,
of those three.
I love these stories. I can listen to them all the time. The great ones in football. There's a book, Ernie Accorsi was a longtime general manager.
Yeah.
He wrote a book called The GM a few years ago. He told a great story in there about when he was working for the Cleveland Browns, just starting out, Paul Brown, who the Browns were named after, was at the draft. They were doing it by phone. This is like 1957. And he's like, okay, the next guy on our list was Len Dawson, who was a Hall of Fame quarterback. And right before him, Pittsburgh took Len Dawson. And Paul Brown was devastated. He was holding his head, and they're like, okay, you know, who do we take? Who do we take? And he wouldn't say anything. And so he just grabbed the list. And the next guy on the list, Jim Brown.
Wow.
And the other one I've always been – I was told about once was that – I can't remember which NHL team told me this. But they said there's a reason you never go off your list. You always stay on your list. And he said that he was told by the Dallas Cowboys that when – I think it was Gil Brandt was the general manager – there was only one time they ever went off their list,
mm-hmm.
only once. And they drafted a player, a linebacker by the name of Larry Bethea, who, you know, didn't turn out to be a great player. Do you know who was on their list that they should have taken if they would have done it? Joe Montana.
Yeah, not bad. The greatest of all time.
That's why they say you always, I remember that story. That's why you always go with your list. Right, always.
One final draft story for me, and we'll move on unless you have more. I want to go back
That's it for me.
The 2006 draft, again, had another great story with it and involves the Western Hockey League and the Tri-City Americans and Olaf Kolzig. So that's the Vancouver draft. So Eric Johnson goes first overall. The order that year is St. Louis, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Washington, Boston. Okay. That's the order for your top five. St. Louis takes a defenseman, Eric Johnson. Pittsburgh takes Jordan Staal.
Yes.
Second. So now there was a feeling that Chicago was going to take the American kid, Phil Kessel.
Yep.
Now let me give pause here and give you some backstory. Olaf Kolzig, who was a goaltender for the Washington Capitals at that point, who ends up going on stage to help make the selection with Alexander Ovechkin at four, is one of the owners of the Tri-City Americans.
Yes.
And in the Western Hockey League Bantam Draft, they select first overall.
Yes.
Okay, so when you make a first overall selection, you better make sure that that kid is coming and he's not going anywhere else. They take Jonathan Toews from Winnipeg with the belief that he's coming. Jonathan Toews ends up going to North Dakota, and their first overall pick is scotched. What's the saying when you miss on a first overall pick or miss on a first-round pick? You set your organization back a couple of seasons. It's that way in the NHL, and it's that way in junior hockey. So Kolzig is, interestingly enough, you know, not too thrilled
yes.
that Jonathan Toews has decided to go to Nodak instead of playing with the Tri-City Americans of the Western Hockey League. So it comes to number two, and then everyone's of the belief that Chicago is going to take Phil Kessel. And everyone's saying to themselves, uh-oh, that means Washington's at four. And that means Washington is probably going to take Jonathan Toews.
Mm.
And Kolzig is going up on stage with Alex Ovechkin to make the pick. Would that not be the frostiest handshake, welcome to the team, Olaf Kolzig shaking Jonathan Toews' hand as he welcomes him as a member of the Washington Capitals? It all goes away because Chicago takes Jonathan Toews.
Yeah.
But I remember after Pittsburgh took Jordan Staal, I had two people from the floor text me right away, uh-oh, this might be something. Pay attention to Washington's pick if Chicago doesn't take Phil Kessel.
That's like Pete Rozelle handing the Super Bowl trophy to Al Davis. That's a really old reference. I can do those draft stories forever and ever, man.
Draft's the best. Want to get to one thing quickly before we officially start the podcast here as we just open up rambling. This is a carryover from last week. I mentioned Karen Douglas. And so she sent in this question, hashtag ask31. We'll do more questions later.
Yep.
For consideration for the podcast, do you think having instant video access to analysis for their entire lives has factored into the creativity of players? This TED Talk, and she sends along the link, on dance always comes to mind.
The story starts with just a single person, a child, behaving a little strangely. This kid's known online as a little demon. He's doing tricks here, dance tricks, that probably no six-year-old in history ever managed before. How did he learn them? And what drove him to spend the hundreds of hours of practice this must have taken?
Step your game up, oh! Step your game up, oh!
So that was sent me by filmmaker Jonathan Chu, who told me that was the moment he realized the internet was causing dance to evolve. I mean, in essence, dancers were challenging each other online to get better. Incredible new dance skills were being invented. Even the six-year-olds were joining in. I mean, it felt like a revolution. And so John had a brilliant idea. He went out to recruit the best of the best dancers off of YouTube to create this dance troupe, the League of Extraordinary Dancers, the LXD. I mean, these kids were web-taught, but they were so good, they got to play the Oscars this year. So This story of the evolution of dance seems strangely familiar. These cycles of improvement apparently driven by people watching web video. What is going on here? Well, I think it's the latest iteration of a phenomenon we can call crowd-accelerated innovation.
Players are growing up right now, watching themselves on video, watching other players on video, with a huge library to draw from. When I played hockey in the MTHL years ago, you went and you played, and the next day at practice, your coach pieced together what the game was like and things to fix. But now you have video. Like, even at my son's game, like, my wife videotapes the games and then emails at a private link on YouTube out to every parent on the team. Kids grow up watching all of their games, watching their practices, watching other players, watching NHLers. Like, nothing is hidden anymore. Very seldom do you say, wow, I was at the rink, but there were no cameras to capture any of this.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't happen anymore. And we see it in other sports as well. You're more of an authority than me. We're seeing exponential growth when it comes to skill.
I think there's a couple of things. I think that's it. You know, you can figure out what you did wrong or what somebody else did right much faster than you used to. I think that's a huge thing. We're growing a generation of visual learners now. Nobody reads anymore. Everybody looks at screens, so it's easier. But I think the major reason is that we know how to train ourselves better. We know how to take care of ourselves better. The differences in sports science in terms of what we understand about what we can do is astronomical. Colorado was in Toronto the other day. They won. And, you know, I was talking to some of their young players, and Alex Kerfoot said that the number one thing he noticed right away is how well the veterans take care of their bodies.
Mm-hmm.
The Landeskog, the Eric Johnson. Like, Eric Johnson's a beast. And I think that's what it is. It's, you are trained now from a young age how to optimize your body. And I think between that, the video, the knowledge, you know what, Jeff, if you don't do the best job you can to optimize yourself, it's your own fault. You can't blame anybody else.
And you're not giving yourself the best chance. I remember talking to one AHL coach who brought up the point and said, you know, if you're a professional athlete, why would you even have one beer? Why would you not just say to yourself, I'm taking the next 10 years and trying to do this thing perfectly, and I'm going to eat clean.
And just do it all when you're done.
And do it all when you're done. John Tortorella had interesting comments this week about Columbus playing in Vegas.
Yes, the playing guilty.
And he said, you know what? I want my guys to go out because one of the things, I'm paraphrasing here, one of the things we've lost in the game is playing guilty. You know, playing guilty has been part of the
NHL. I just want everybody
NHL.
To know that we still broadcast guilty. You all have to know that.
It's not really your job until you broadcast guilty. And then if you still have a job afterwards, then it's your gig. See, that is completely changed. Like, pretty much all NHLers you talk to, guys that we work with, we'll talk about the phenomenon of playing guilty. Uh-oh, I was overserved last night. I better really bring it tonight. And guys will cover for you. I remember Colby told me the story once of the next day at practice when someone's particularly hungover, how do you make sure the coach doesn't know? And he said, you know, one of the tricks was always rubbing, you know, Vicks Vapor Rub all over your chest and all over your neck.
It didn't smell.
The coach has a suspicion that you may have been overpoured the night before. He'll come up right up to you and do a close talk situation.
Yeah.
So the vapor rub on the chest will generally back that up a little bit. But that's all changed. The idea of playing guilty now in the era of 23 guys and 23 cabs at the end of a game or end of a practice. The days of, okay, I'm Phil Esposito, and at the end of every practice, I'm making sure that everybody goes to the bar for one beer. After that, you're your own person, but we're still a team. But after that one beer at the bar, we're done.
Yeah, well, I think it happens more in the summer. That's when players let it go while they're training or doing whatever. You're a Toronto guy, right?
Yeah.
So one of the biggest stories when I was a kid was around 1980. It was Punch Imlach. And he was the coach, and the Leafs hated him. It was the second time around, and they just despised him.
Mm-hmm.
And Jim Kernahan, who passed away, was a columnist in Toronto, and he was invited to a post-practice liquid lunch where Punch Imlach's face was put on a dartboard. And I think it was like Dave Hutchinson and Daryl Sittler threw darts at it. And he wrote it without naming the players.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a huge story because I believe that's the story that got Scott Young to quit the Globe and Mail. He thought that story was wrong, that it was printed with anonymous sources. And he thought that wasn't fair, and he quit. But also, I just remember what a huge deal it was, and thinking now, would there ever be a day where I would be invited to a post-practice liquid lunch.
No.
Never mind just where somebody was throwing darts at a picture of their coach, but stop it after post-practice liquid lunch. Like, I think those days are over. Mm-hmm. Now, at the draft, you can sit down and have a few beers with some people who were there because there's a lot of people there. But that's the place now where you can do that. But those aren't players. And I really agree with you, Jeff. In season, those days are over. Now, I used to have a thing that if I was ever out somewhere and players went, I left. And there was one time when I was working at Hockey Night. It was early in my time there. And I was out at a bar and a bunch of players showed up and we saw each other and I waved and I left. And the next day at the morning skate, one of the players said to me, like, how come you walked out? And I said, you guys see enough of me. Mm-hmm. You don't need to see me when you're trying to have a good time.
Okay, let me bring
And he said he really appreciated it.
Let me bring you into my world then, because the gym that I work out at, just outside of Stouffville and Gormley, is all hockey players.
Okay.
And I always say the same thing when I meet a new player, whether it's OHL, AHL, NHL. I introduce myself, whether I know the player or not, and I say, listen, you guys are here in the summer to train. I want you guys to feel comfortable. I don't want to think all that media guy's writing stuff down or typing things into his phone, and he's going to blather about all this. I said, everything in here is completely off the record, and I will never repeat what I hear.
Yeah.
I want you guys to feel as comfortable as possible. Now, what I've done is, in the summers, generally, the guys will roll in around 8 or 9 o'clock. I'll try to get my workout done between 6 and 7, just so I don't have that conflict, because I don't want to make guys feel uncomfortable when they're training. I don't think it's fair to the owner of the gym, the trainers, anything else, to have the media guy hanging around doing his workout while these guys just want to be hockey players.
Yeah.
Because
I'm with you.
They don't want that. They need an environment where they can speak freely to one another.
I completely agree with you. I am that way. I like to stay out of people's way. I don't like to ask people for anything. I don't want them to see me as like a guy that they ask them for stuff. Aside the annoying questions I bring. But I'm like that, Jeff. I'm like, you're in your private space. You don't need me there.
With that, we'll start the podcast.
This is Doug McLean. When I was an NHL GM, I didn't have a lot of time for Jeff and Elliot. And now that I'm an analyst, I still don't.
Elliot, this week in 31 Thoughts, you write about the Department of Player Safety. And is there a better way to do this? It's interesting. A lot of this touchstone is the Dustin Brown, Justin Schultz hit.
It's a combination. It's Dustin Brown, it's Andrew Cogliano.
And the Andrew Cogliano, which we talked about last week, a lot of players were hot about the fact that there was a suspension and perhaps the idea that he's on an Ironman streak should have been taken into consideration. Park that for a second, and I'm glad you brought up the Sean Couturier situation in that game with New Jersey, and it was Paul Mary who caught him. So I was working the afternoon with John Shannon. We saw the hit. We said, uh-oh, is there going to be the same firestorm? And kind of laughed knowing there's not going to be the exact same firestorm as there was with Dustin Brown. How would they, in your estimation, quote-unquote, do it differently or handle supplemental discipline differently?
Well, I don't know if they would. This is my idea. I have brought this up to people so they don't think they should do it this way, but I'm different. Jeff, I've been in the business now. The people who've run Department of Player Safety, Brian Burke, Colin Campbell, Brendan Shanahan, Stefan Quintel, and now George Parros. And prior to Parros, this job ate up those four people. Burke had enough. Campbell had enough. Shanahan had enough over a shorter span.
Yep.
Quintel really had enough over a shorter span than Shanahan. And, you know, when Parros got the job, everybody was ecstatic because he's a smart guy and a popular guy. And that lasted, what, 5 months? I think this job eats up people. It's the toughest job in the sport. Nobody really wants it. Everybody hates you. Everybody questions you. It's, you know, you got to be tough to do this job, and then you got to be double tough.
I remember Brian Burke once made the comment. I was talking to him once, and he said, it's the worst job in the NHL because every day you wake up, you have to know one thing. Everyone thinks you're an idiot.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, Burke's worn that coat very well over his career. But, you know, I reach a point where you say, okay, and all this anger last week, and you're right, they were upset about Cogliano, and then everybody kind of came to grips with it. And then the Brown non-suspension ripped open all the wounds. Because you saw the Penguins on the ice when he did. It's like this guy again.
Yeah.
And so my question now is the rule is, or the way they do it is, they don't consider your history until they've decided you've got a suspension.
Okay, just so everyone's on the same page here. Your history cannot dictate the suspension. It can only enhance how many games you get once it's determined that an infraction has occurred that rises to the level of supplemental discipline.
Yes. So until they've decided that, your history doesn't matter. I think that it's time to change that. Now, somebody pointed out to me that Dustin Brown's history is actually not as bad as you'd think it is. He's only been suspended once, and he hasn't really been on the radar in about 2 years. And I said, sure, but he's always around. So, Jeff, whenever you deal with someone, whether it's your kids mm-hmm. or a coworker or a friend, and an issue comes up, don't you always look at their history and let that define the way you do things? Like if you have a kid who's a troublemaker and he or she does something, you're going to have less patience because they're a troublemaker.
Certainly, but aren't there two standards? There's a societal standard and then there's a standard of law.
You know what? Sure, but you can...
It is.
As long as you can adhere to the standard, you can do it. But my point is that the way it is, we've made it the worst job in the league. We've made it so that good people don't want anything to do with it. And everybody always complains about it. Everybody probably always will complain about it. But I don't understand how when history matters in almost every decision we do, mm-hmm. we've decided it doesn't matter here until the end. I don't think that's the way it should be. And I thought that last week was wrong. And I will say this. I don't believe for a second that these guys do their job with any bias. I respect the fact that Parros and his staff believe it should be done a way and they held to that way even if it was unpopular. I just think there's a better way they could be served about doing it. The process could be better.
So you would have suspended Dustin Brown?
I would have. Well, actually, I shouldn't say that. I don't know if I would have, but what I would have done was introduced his history sooner in the process.
In the explanation?
Like what they currently say is, we're not looking at Dustin Brown's history until we decide if this hit is a suspension. You walk that line, and that's what happens.
Everybody has a different interpretation of different players. Like, I personally think that Shane Doan was a very dirty hockey player when he played. That is not a popular opinion. And that is not an opinion that is shared by most people. Just because he did it all with a smile.
Yeah.
And he was nice guy Shane Doan. But when you look at how Shane Doan played, he was a dirty hockey player.
Well, yeah. And he was a guy who got suspended by the league when the league owed the team late in the season while they were chasing a playoffs. Like, that is under the radar one of the toughest suspensions the league ever gave.
Mm-hmm.
Guys can be nice guys and still be dirty on the ice.
Paul Mary, Couturier, rose to suspension as well?
No.
Same play.
It was the same play. But again, I look at it differently because the guy's got no history.
She said, now we're getting into intent.
Yeah.
Right. So what you're saying is I believe that Dustin Brown intended to hurt Justin Schultz, just like there was intent or there may not have been intent in Paul Mary and Couturier.
I think that Brown has proven that he's reckless.
But with only one suspension in his hip pocket,
he's always around there. Like the hurdle thing was borderline.
Yeah.
Like, for example, and I actually didn't put this in the blog. Remember when Rafi Torres hit Jarrett Stoll?
Of course.
Like Rob Blake basically resigned from player safety over that suspension. And why did Torres get suspended? Because he was Rafi Torres.
This is Rafi Torres with a huge rap sheet.
But that was a situation where people felt the history got involved.
Let me ask you this then. Do you need to, and I talked to John Shannon about this on TV yesterday. If you're going to be the head of the Department of Player Safety.
Yes.
Do you have to be an ex-player? Here's the discussion we had around. The discussion was around the idea of intent. And again, I'm always reluctant to pull the authenticity card. Like, I don't think you need to have to jump in front of a subway to know that if you do, it won't tickle. So I'm always about the authenticity card. But in this situation, if we're going to deal with things like intent in the NHL, do you have to have played in the NHL to understand intent? And where I'm going at with this one is, you know, those names you just rattled off most recently, Brendan, just as all post Colin Campbell, Brendan Shanahan, Stefan Quintal, George Parros, mm-hmm. these are all guys who played. But going back to Campbell, the one constant in the department is Damian Echevarria.
Yes.
Could a case not be made that if you take it away from someone who played the game, and if you want to, you know, be consistent with, you know, the suspensions that have gone before, and someone that has seen the entire body of work that this department has done, at a certain point, don't you say to yourself, from a PR point of view, maybe it makes sense that we have the ex-player?
I don't believe...
But this guy's done it since Colin Campbell.
I don't necessarily believe in the PR point of view. You should do it for that reason.
You don't think optics is part of this?
Nah, it always is, but I wouldn't make that call for this reason. The only reason I would make that call is because I think he's the best person for the job, and we are getting to a point where he might be. Like, if George Parros decides he doesn't want to do this anymore, I think when you've been there for 20 years and you know where everything is and you see everything's been done, I think absolutely he would be a great candidate. I think the biggest question is, you know that people are going to come at you because you never played. How does everybody handle that?
Hang on, who's everybody? Just
you'll
players?
Get players. I'm sure during hearings, the Players Association will come at you with that.
Do you get a sense that players like or are disdainful of former players suspending them and by extension taking money out of their pocket?
No, you know.
That was one of the criticisms of Shanahan, as you'll recall. This guy played. How can he suspend me, take money out of my pocket?
I think people.
You heard that from players.
But I agree with that. But I think people say that about anybody who punishes them, right? We all hate everybody.
But it's egregious. Like, we were brothers in a locker. We both paid Players Association dues.
Well, there's a whole other story there.
I get that.
But you know, I think that they're going to complain about anybody who suspends them. The bottom line is, do you think that person has a thick enough skin to handle the job? We know this is a brutal job, the hardest job. My question is, if you're going to give it to somebody who didn't play, do you think they're the right person for the job? And he could be. Like you said, he's been doing
it
for 20 years.
Forever.
He knows where all the bodies are buried. I would like to see George Parros continue to do this for a while because I think he's really smart. Mm-hmm. And I have been impressed by the fact that he believes that this is the right decision. I'm going with it even though people don't like it. I just think that last week was not good. And after 20 years of seeing people chewed up and spit out by this job, I'm just wondering if we should do the process differently.
Quick story time to wrap up this discussion in the Department of Player Safety. Marty McSorley told me this story about Brian Burke when he had that title. Marty would have been playing for Los Angeles at that point. And he said he always wanted to fight Eric Lindros, and Eric would never do it. Eric scores a goal against LA, big celebration. Marty bumps him. Eric pushes him back, and they both drop their gloves. And Marty says to himself, wow, finally I've got Eric Lindros in a situation where I want him. I've tried to fight this guy, you know, since he joined the NHL. And so they fight, and it appears that Eric bites him, that he bites Marty. And he says, well, Brian Burke calls, and Brian says, listen, Marty, we can't do anything with Eric Lindros unless you say that he bit you. Now, I'm going to ask you, did Eric Lindros bite you? And Marty says, well, you know, things happen in a fight. I don't know, a bite, a scratch. I don't know. It's hard to say. And Brian says, I'm going to ask you one more time, one final time, because I can't do anything unless you tell me this, Marty, or else this goes nowhere. Did he bite you? And Marty says, he paused, he took a breath, and he said, Brian, Eric Lindros didn't bite me. Now you call Bobby Clark and tell him he owes me one.
Hmm.
Marty McSorley, Eric Lindros. Also in 30 Thoughts this week, Elliot, you talk about the Ottawa Senators, and it is never a good thing when the general manager goes into the room to talk to the players. What is happening in Canada's nation's capital?
Well, they had a five-day break. They came back. They played St. Louis last Thursday night, and they got killed.
Steen for Petrangelo. Great rink white clear for Braden Schenn to the empty net. Score! Senators have just pulled their goaltender, and Braden Schenn finds the back of the net.
And Pierre Dorion went into the room the next day. I don't know if it was before practice or after practice. And he basically said to them, why is this happening? Not as nicely as I'm saying it. Why is this happening? Why are we so bad? And I heard the players were pretty blunt with their assessments. Now, somebody asked me, did they tear down their coach? I don't think they did. I didn't hear that, and I didn't get any indication that was there. I don't think they asked Dorian about who was getting traded or anything like that. I didn't get that impression either. But I heard it was just a really blunt, honest meeting. And there's a GM in the league who gave me a great saying that I always stick with. And the saying is, there's only two moods in sports, winning and hell.
It's great.
And right now it's hell for the Ottawa Senators. I think the thing I'm worried about for them is, are there going to be long-term ramifications for this franchise? You know, there are reports now, Bruce Garriott reported today in the paper that they're not going to trade Carlson and Stone this year. It just constantly seems to be a moving target about who is available and who isn't.
Stone's a little surprising. Carlson almost seems that the writing's on the wall there. But
Stone is a hell of a player. You're going to have to keep somebody. And also the other thing, and you know, this can be a factor, is they're both represented by Newport, same agency. So sometimes when that's the case, I wonder if, you know, there's a team here that's worried about dealing with a certain agency or upsetting a certain agent, and they're like, we have to deal with these guys similarly.
They used to pair tough guys like that with skilled players. Hey, you just drafted my skill guy. How about taking our tough guy as well to make sure he's happy?
Absolutely.
That does happen.
It's funny how that works, yeah. Right? But I worry about, for the Senators and their fans, will this year have long-term implications?
In what sense? Like really drilling this franchise back 10 years?
I don't know. I don't like to be quite that melodramatic, but look, like we went up there for the outdoor game, and that was a beautiful weekend. Like the team did a great job. The league did a great job. The fans there did a great job. I mean, what a fantastic 4 days that was to be in Ottawa for the outdoor game. And then, you know, Eugene Melnyk blows up the day before and I think has such a pall over the season. As you know, Jeff, the rumors don't stop about the sale and they keep getting denied. And, you know, is the league going to get involved? Are the Desmarais family going to buy the team and move them downtown? What's the story with downtown? There just is such a negative cloud over that team right now. And, you know, watching last Saturday night, you know, it's always like this, but it seemed really bad, like a Leaf home game for them.
Oh, those goals go in the third period, and the place pops like the cork.
Like, I believe any franchise can recover from anything if you're good enough, but I really do worry for the Senators that they're doing some damage to their brand, their organization, and their standing in the city.
You know, we talk so much, and Colorado's a touchstone for this. New Jersey's a touchstone for this as well. We keep talking the last few years about how quickly a team can turn around. Maple Leafs are another example of that as well. I mean, the flip side of that, the shady side of the mountain to the sunny side of the mountain is, as quickly as a team can turn around, a team can unravel just as fast.
This league is weird,
In the NHL
right
now. Look
at Colorado.
That's what I'm saying. Like, yeah. Colorado's the opposite of that, and New Jersey's the opposite of that. You can turn things around pretty quickly in the NHL right now with a couple of moves. And listen, luck and health are always a common denominator here. But just as quickly as things can turn around, things can unravel real fast.
And they have. And that's why Edmonton and Montreal, it's all about, okay, we're having nightmare years this year. How can we be next year better? Like Edmonton's thinking, we have Connor McDavid. We can still contend next year.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, you know, it's funny too, because in the salary cap era, and the analytic guys always talk about this, there's always that one team. Minnesota was it 1 year. Colorado was it with Patrick Waugh. Calgary with Hartley. The Maple Leafs in the lockout season. There's the one team that has a shooting percentage that's way too high and a save percentage that's way too high. And sometimes you just get lucky and you can surf for an entire season on it. But the analytics guys will tell you it's a fraud and a crash is coming.
Yep.
And that's those teams. And we saw it, right? There has to be the opposite to that as well. You know, there has to be, you know, to go all Taoist, you know, there has to be the opposite of that team who's, you know, dining out and punching way above their weight. There has to be the opposite. And I can't help thinking that, and maybe more so Edmonton than Montreal, there has to be the opposite, and I'm guessing it's got to be the Edmonton Oilers.
Well, they would be a good pick. Like, if you're going to put money down, that's the team you're putting it on, right? Like, is Klefbom as bad as he was this year? Is Larson as bad as he was this year? I just don't believe it.
The problem with all that is you don't have a whole lot of wiggle room to figure that out because Connor goes from 3.5 to 12.
Right, but, you know, you are going to get a boost in the cap. You know, you will have some other things you got to deal with. You're right.
But you're not getting a $9 million boost.
No. You've got some things you've got to deal with. There's no question about that. But I think you take your chance with a nuclear weapon on your side. But, you know, there's no question that Bergevin believes the same thing. He's like, you know, why can't we be Colorado next year?
Do they have enough young players? See, one of the keys is young players.
Yeah.
And do the Montreal Canadiens, John Drouin is still a young player. I get that. But do they have enough young players to turn this around? It's tough to turn it around when you have an aging group. New Jersey turns it around, how have they done it, young players. Colorado turns it around, how have they done it, young players.
Mm-hmm.
Does Montreal have that?
They don't have that. You know, if they win a lottery, they'll have one very good one. Or they go high, they'll have one very good one. Or they'll throw $1 billion at John Tavares and say, come be our guy.
Well, listen, the Connor lottery was...
$1 billion.
Big time. Matthews lottery was big time.
55 Molson distributorships across Quebec.
Yeah. I mean, this is going to be a fascinating lottery as well. Any more thoughts on Ottawa before we hustle along to the next one?
Like I said, I just worry for the franchise. Not like they're going to move or anything, but I know people in Ottawa are worried they're doing damage.
You wrote about the Colorado Avalanche in town, beat the Toronto Maple Leafs, takes the win streak to 10 wins in a row. It's mm-hmm. one of the best stories outside of Vegas in the NHL right now. Last team, by the way, to beat the Colorado Avalanche was the Arizona Coyotes.
Uh-huh.
Strangely enough,
they're starting to play better.
They are, and briefly, they're out of 30th
yes.
for a couple of minutes.
Yes.
But still, they are playing better.
They are getting better.
Amazing what happens when your back end gets healthy and you get a save. And you wrote about Samuel Girard.
He's tiny.
Okay, here's the thing. I know, but we talked about
it. I didn't realize it. He's tiny.
Joe Hickett's made his debut for the Detroit
Red Wings. Another tiny guy.
Another small guy. He's too small. Dave Lowry, Victoria Royals. He's never going to make it. He's never drafted. He gets signed by the Red Wings. Samuel Girard in the QMJHL draft. Probably should have gone first overall, but he was a left-hand shot, and there was a guy named Luke Green, who was a right-shot defenseman
that
St. John ended up taking first overall. Pascal
LeBerge.
This
is why I like doing this podcast with Jeff. Like, he knows things I have no clue existed. That's a good one.
Some of the things are even true.
Like, yes.
I got a lot of stories, and some of them are even true. So he ends up going third to Shawinigan, and if you look back on it now, and you talk to people around the Sea Dogs, they'll probably tell you, yeah, we probably should have taken Sam Girard. With that first overall pick. And the door is opening wide for all these smallish-type defensemen now. I don't think you can have an entire back end like that. I think you still do need some muscle back there so you don't get pushed off the puck down low. But the door is wide open more so than ever for players like Samuel Girard.
You know, I'm looking at him, and I'm like, I can't believe how small he is. I didn't realize. And it was funny. I was talking with a couple of their players about it, and they said the first time he walked in, they were all like, okay, this is the guy we got for Matt Duchene. All right.
What's the old Mike Keane line when they had that backup, the goaltender from UBC come in? He was about 5'0". Mike Keane walks up to him. He's in for head. Who would have been injured there? Anyway, they bring up a UBC goaltender to fill in to back up, and Mike Keane walks up to him in the room and goes, where's the rest of you?
There's another one like that. You know Spud Webb, the NBA
player?
Yeah, of
course. Yeah.
So he got recruited from junior college to go play at North Carolina State, and the late Jim Valvano was the coach there. And he said when his recruiter showed up with the player, he turned to his recruiter and said, if this is Spud Webb, you're fired. And he turned out to be a heck of a player. But you know, then they got on the ice with him, and you can see it. You know, he's smart.
So good.
He's great with his stick. And he doesn't get hit.
His passing.
His passing is phenomenal. And they realized, they said that was one of the reasons they really think their season took off. And everybody is, you know, kicking Matt Duchene. And I don't want to kick that guy when he's down. It's enough.
He's played well lately.
Yeah.
Four goals in the last six or something like that.
But again, like, you know, MacKinnon talked yesterday about it.
Yeah. Because
he was asked, so he answered the question. But, you know, so I don't want to kick Matt Duchene when he's down. But one of the things that they did admit was, they realized they were going to be okay when they saw Girard. Like, when they got him on the ice and they saw what he could do, they were like, wow, you know, we got a player here. And I think that energized them a bit. But, you know, they got a lot of guys like, you know, Alex Kerfoot's not a big guy. Jost and Compher are not big guys, but they're thick. Like, you can see the muscle on them. You know who's a real much bigger guy than you realize is Eric Johnson. Like, he is...
Are you kidding?
He's a beast.
He's giant.
But, you know, I just, like, physically, too. And I just thought it was interesting how Kerfoot said that the one thing he noticed right away was, and it goes back to what we said earlier, is, like, those guys take care of their bodies.
Yeah.
Every day.
Future of Tyson Barrie there, you wrote about it in 31 Thoughts. They're winning without him. Does that factor into any of this? Much like we talked about Winnipeg and they're winning without, they won without Dustin Byfuglien. Does that factor in decisions there?
You know, I don't know. The thing about Byfuglien is that they still don't have certainty on Trouba, right? So I don't know if you're considering doing that. But the one thing about Barrie is that I could see, like, if I'm the New York Islanders, and you need a scoring or a puck moving D, is he not a guy you're looking at right now?
Leafs tried to make a move in the summer.
Yes,
did they not?
The Leafs have had interest in Tyson Barry before. There's no question about that. I don't know if it was this summer or a year ago, but I do think that there are going to be teams who are going to ask Colorado, what are you doing with Tyson Barry here?
It's going to get to our interview here with Mark Savard.
Saturday, it's going to be a good day. Always is. It's because of all the games during the week. The one played on Saturday night is a special one. This is the story of a love affair between a country and a game. If you want to try and teach someone about Canada, you go to the television Saturday night and it becomes crystal clear. Hockey Night in Canada on CBC and Sportsnet.
Thomas going to the Boston bench. The Bruins are going to go on the power play in overtime here. Thanks to an odd man rush. Schaefer slips it through. Wide with far side shot. Scores! Mark Savard! The Boston Bruins are back in it!
Well, we give Sturm a bump. Savard quickly after the puck to Murray. The shot scores! You come to Boston, you're playing with fire. These guys are doing a lot of things right now.
Nice tight cycle. And how about this backhand feed by Savard? It's an aerial pass that lands at the perfect time.
Cook Savard thing. You could call it a cheap shot, blind shot, a late hit. You could call it what you want, and it should have been a suspension as far as I'm concerned.
Lucic over the line to Chatham, the shot up high. It goes over Fleury's goal. And tempers are rising down in the corner.
He got the back diagonal pass from Milan Lucic, and it was Cook that was coming in on the back check from the blind side, and I believe it was Cook ended up making contact with Savard.
This is Mark Savard. Don Del Negro is already out having a look at him. A lot of concern for Mark Savard right now.
Mark Savard, you played with him, Bob. I know you have a lot of respect for the way he plays the game. He's a great playmaker, one of the real creative passers in the game.
One of the best in the game. Top five.
Big concern here for Mark Savard, and what did you think of what happened there on that play, Barry?
Well, I'm especially concerned here for Bruins fans after watching what happened, 3 years ago to Patrice Bergeron being carried off similar fashion and causing a concussion, and you only hope for Mark Savard that he will be all right.
Hands it on, Chara shot, turned aside by Boucher.
In this building right now, there are 20,000 people saluting your name. What does that feel like?
It's unbelievable. I didn't think this day would come this quick. I had a tough stretch of days, as everybody knows, and I'm just happy to be back with my buddies and be here in Boston.
Please be joined now by Mark Savard, who yesterday officially called it a career. Mark, thanks for joining us on the podcast today. And first of all, before we get into the specifics of your career, even going back to your Oshawa days, playing in the OHL. Congratulations on a wonderful career. When I threw out on Twitter yesterday that you were going to be our guest, I had this weird mix of people that were excited about you coming on and were angry. And the anger came from people feeling ripped off that they didn't get to see you play hockey enough. How do you feel now that it's officially all done?
Well, and I thank you for saying the nice things you did. I was upset at the time, about 5-6 years ago when it came all to fruition that I wasn't going to play much more, and I knew that in my own head. There were some tough days to deal with, but as I got through the days and started doing other things, kept my mind occupied, I was able to get at peace with it quicker. I'm still frustrated at times when I watch the game because I still love and miss it and want to give everything and every single minute I have back to it. But it's upsetting, like I said, at times. But in another sentence, I got to do some other things that I might not have done, be around my kids more, and enjoy other special things for sure.
Mark, how's your health?
My health's good now. I'm actually in a good place right now. I'm able to do a lot of things that I didn't do earlier on since I haven't played. I'm enjoying everything I'm doing more. There were some grumpy times for sure, right after I was injured and being out, and the first couple of years where I were pretty miserable. But, now I'm really enjoying life, taking a day at a time, getting into some new stuff. Like I said, I want to be a coach and do some stuff like that. I've coached my kids in AAA, and I'm looking to move forward in that end of things. So, like I said, I'm just taking a day at a time, but I'm really enjoying it. My family's great. We have a great time and just enjoying life.
You know, it's good to hear that because last week we saw in Philadelphia, Eric Lindros got his number retired. And he was a guy whose career was damaged by concussions. But I look at him now and I see a guy who's at peace, good family, happily married, a guy who's at peace with his life. And now to hear this for you, a guy who battled concussions, good family, at peace with his life, I think it's important, Mark, that as we're trying to understand the world of concussions and what they mean, and I think we've barely scratched the surface as to what they mean, people can hear that from you and see how Eric is doing and say, you know what, this isn't a death sentence. This is something that we can look at and say, you can live a happy life if you have to battle through this.
Well, that's exactly it, Elliot. There was tough days along the way, but, you know, having that strong family and being able to push forward and have the kids that I do, I have four wonderful kids, you know, they made it all worthwhile, you know, the bad times that I had and moving forward. And there is other things to do in life. Hockey is a game, as much as we all love it, and it's something we all are blessed to do if you're lucky to be even around it, as you guys are. But in other words, it's just a game and there's more important things. And now I'm able to enjoy those things and a little sooner than I would have liked, because I still would have loved to play the game and see how much further I could have done with things as I was a player. But now to enjoy my family, my kids, and so on, and start the next chapter in my life a little earlier is exciting too. So I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully everything goes well.
Mark, I want to ask you one final thing about concussions, and we'll move on, and we'll talk about hockey, and we'll talk about other parts of your career. I can recall having one very specific conversation with a good friend of mine. She's a doctor, Dr. Allie Rendley. She's done some work with Dr. Charles Tater in the past. And she said, "You hockey guys make me laugh." And I said, "Why is that?" And she said, "You think that concussions only occur when you get hit in the head. You guys are so fixated on getting hit in the head, and concussions certainly do occur when that happens. But she said, I treat more people with concussions got hit in the stomach than they got hit in the head. You guys are fixated on the head. It's not just your head that can cause concussions." And that really opened my eyes to a lot of things. From your point of view and from your experience, Mark, what are some of the things that people don't understand about concussions that they probably should?
Well, I think the toughest thing for me and a lot of athletes that go through concussions is you can't see it from the outside. And I think that it's a tough thing to deal with as a person, because, you know, you break your ankle, you got a cast on or a boot, you break your arm, you got a cast on or something, and you separate your shoulder, you know, so on, so on. A concussion is just like, oh, he looks fine today. Like, what's going on here? Why is he not going to play? Or he's talking to that person, he looks totally fine. It's the hours that no one sees behind the walls and the lights and all the stuff going on that you really, really struggle with, and depression stuff and so on. There's such a list of stuff that I went on, and I had great help from Dr. Tater. He's one of the best. I owe a lot of where I am today from Dr. Tater and his staff. But there's just so much people don't see on the outside, and that's the one message that I think I would translate if I had an opportunity to talk in front of a group, which hopefully down the road I'm going to get more of. And it's just something that's really tough and something that, you know, like I said, you just can't explain it enough.
You could be so important on that front. You really could, Mark. I get the sense that you understand that. Elliot just mentioned, you know, Eric Lindros and the work that he's done, you know, through his various charitable foundations and getting out and talking about concussions and talking about that message. Do you almost get a sense that, you know, now that you've gone through this, now that you want to have a public life in and around hockey, this is something and an area where you can really help people?
Yes, I agree. And I'm part of the Parachute Fund with Dr. Tater, and I'm on that staff. So I look forward to doing more things down the road here. We've reached out. I've gone to a couple things that he's held, and hopefully down the road I can get more comfortable speaking about this stuff in front of a crowd, because I know it goes a long way, and I've had nothing but great well wishes from every fan that I've had along the way, and especially the overwhelming support after the retirement the other day just is astonishing. So it says more that I can be such a fixture in this world to help other people just by looking at the wishes that I got from everybody the other day.
All right, let's go more uplifting, because this is a celebration of Mark's career, which
Certainly.
Was a fantastic career. So, Mark, do you follow Phil Kessel on Twitter?
Yes, I do.
Okay, so I'm looking at his Twitter page right now, and the first seven words of his bio are, "Nice guy, tries hard, loves the game." That's you. Explain where that comes from.
Oh, we used to, when Phil came in the league, we'd always talk about a guy, and if a guy wasn't really a great player, we'd always frame him in that category. What do you think of this guy? And we'd always say, he's a nice guy, tries hard, loves a game. So that's kind of how we framed a guy that was an average player.
I was talking to one of your ex-teammates yesterday, and I don't want to say who it is because I don't want to embarrass Jason York like that. But I was talking to one of your ex-teammates yesterday and said, hey, we've got Mark Savard coming on. He goes, no one taped a stick better. Nobody taped a hockey stick better than Mark Savard. He was perfect to the point where he would look at my stick and grab and say, that's a horrible tape job. I'm doing it. True or false? You would take guys' hockey sticks and retape it for them.
That is true. Yes, I would. And Yorkie, I could have retaped his stick every single time.
So what's a good tape job? Okay, explain to our listeners then, what's a good tape job in your mind and what's a bad tape job?
I just don't like to see any crevices, any like bumps on it. When you trim the toe of the tape, like I like to cut with scissors around the toe, go right to the toe, and if any little piece is kind of showing or it's crumpled, I would really take my tape right off my stick. I couldn't handle it. So I'd look at a couple other guys. And you know what I know who drives me the most nuts in the league?
That
is Connor McDavid. He doesn't tape his stick between periods. I find that just revolting.
Revolting.
Do you guys have any like mutual friends that you could reach out and tell him that?
Oh, I got Luch. I've told Luch, that's just the way he plays. He goes out with one tape job and away he goes for the whole game. And it makes me feel sick to my stomach.
Okay, Mark, I have to tell you then, don't watch the Boston Bruins too closely and don't watch David Pastrnak because he has the absolute worst tape job on his stick of anybody in the NHL. There's no rhyme to it. There's no reason to it. He just grabs it, throws a couple of rolls around, and that's it. It is what you're talking about. Like, I'm not too fussy about that guy. Not as much as you are, obviously. But that, I will say, is an ugly tape job, probably the worst in the NHL.
I can see it. It actually looks like, you know how guys used to roll their, like some guys still roll the tape for their knob?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It looks like that's on his blade, that roll. It looks like he's rolled it on his blade. It looks horrific.
You should text someone you know in the Bruins organization. Do something about that.
Yeah, I'll text Maddie today. Actually, I'm still good buddies with the trainer, so I'll tell him, pull that tape off the stick. They can tape it right.
That's awesome.
I always love the story about your draft day. And that was a big year for people who don't remember the Oshawa Generals where he played that year. I think he had 10 guys drafted that season. And you were leading scorer in the Ontario Hockey League, but you were not happy. And I've always been amazed that you walked and stepped away out of anger and missed the Rangers taking you. It's an amazing story.
Yeah, it's a story. We were up in Edmonton, and it was my draft year. And, you know, I've been rated kind of third round or maybe late second at times. And then the night before, TSN comes on, obviously. I might have even been Bob McKenzie at the time saying, you know, there could be a surprise pick coming in the first round. I mean, Mark Savard, he's just had this great year and he could move up. And so you can imagine that, being a young kid and being all excited, not sleeping the night before. I could remember going for a walk at like 2 a.m. just because you're like, you're all nervous and you want to get drafted and want everything to happen well. So I'm at the draft and I'm watching. And back then, I think they did all the rounds in the same day, if I'm correct.
Yep. Correct. Back then they did, yep.
Yeah, and I'm sitting up there and, you know, and first round goes by, which I didn't think would happen. Then the second's going, it's getting later, and I see a couple guys off my team go, and I'm like, John Tripp, okay, good year, good, you know, big guy, I can see where it is. Nathan Perreault, and I'm like, yes, good guys, you know, good players, and then I'm still waiting. And then
loves the game, works hard.
Yeah. So anyways, I don't say that about the tougher guys.
Wise decision.
Yeah. So the third round came around and my agent at the time, Larry Kelly, came up to me and he said, yeah, you're going here in the third round. And I forget what team he said at the time. And so it was pretty early in the third. It goes by and you know, time's ticking. So I'm like, enough. And I just kind of, well, I think we left the arena for a bit just to get some air and blah, 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 and came back in. And yeah, I was drafted in the fourth round of the Rangers. So, and, you know, and that's a good lesson for kids listening that it's not where you're chosen. That's just a number, you know, so it's what you do when you get there. So that's a big thing.
You know, I would drive every Sunday, right? Because I work during the week, Monday to Friday. And every Sunday I would drive to Oshawa to watch your Generals play. And I mean, you were head and shoulders. I think you were one of only three players to ever go back-to-back scoring titles, Billy Taylor and Marcel Dion. Back-to-back scoring titles, and you were the third in the OHL. And, you know, you mentioned some of the players on that team, and you were head and shoulders above everybody. When you look back, I think Stan Butler would have coached the team when you were drafted. I think you had a couple of different coaches there in Oshawa around that time. When you look back on your time in junior, to take nothing away from the NHL, was that your favorite time to play hockey?
It certainly was, and I know we touched base yesterday, and that was one of my comments to you. It was. You're just a kid. You got nothing to worry about. You got to get to school and then get to hockey, and you're living away from home. You're like, you feel like you have all this freedom. It's really a special thing and a bond that you make with your buddies. And I mean, I still have a lot of friends from that Oshawa Generals organization, and it's just an incredible time. It's tough to say. You know, a lot of kids only get to play in the OHL. I know that, and they don't get to move on to the NHL, but they've had a pretty good crack at it just going through that. It's pretty professional, and it's like being in a mini NHL, and it's just incredible. The town, the city, the way they take you in, the whole billet thing, living with billets and making new friends and families. It really is an incredible experience. And I've said it all along since the last day I played that those were probably my four most favorite years playing in the OHL.
When you look back and you look back at your time in the OHL, for me, the answer is Billy Bowler, who played with the Windsor Spitfires on the line with Stillman and Warner. Wonderful player and with the organization now. And I always wonder about, from your point of view, guys that you played junior hockey with who you thought going away, this guy is not only going to play in the NHL, but he's going to light it up, and it just never happened for him. There are one or two guys like that that you played in junior said, wow, man, I thought this guy was going to the show all day, all night.
Yeah, there is. And he is one of them for sure. But he's a guy that kind of scared me too because of his size. And everybody tells me, you know, you're too small. You can't do this. You can't do that. So he was one of the guys that actually scared me because I thought, geez, this guy's got everything. Like, he's amazing to watch. He makes fantastic plays. Mm-hmm. Playing in the smallest rink he could ever play in. So he's not scared of anything. But he was one of them. There was a couple of guys. I remember playing this Mike Harding. He used to play for the Petes back in the day. He was a fantastic puck handler and playmaker. I really enjoyed watching him. And there's some guys that were always touted, you know, like in my own years. Like, I remember Jeff Ambrosio guy. I don't know if you guys heard of that name.
Yep.
But yeah, he was highly ranked. I thought he was a great player. There was some guys that I used to play in Belleville. Belleville had that huge rink. And guys, I thought, like, I don't know if I'm moving out here, but guys are flying around me. And and those guys were like, and Richard Park did have a career in the NHL. He was one of the guys that I thought would go on to way bigger things because he was just amazing in junior, but we all thought he was 5 years older, right? Everybody, you guys know that joke, I think, that we all thought he was older than what he was. But him, and there was a Secord kid that played there that was just
Brian
fantastic.
Secord. So, I remember him well. Yeah. Brian Secord, Kevin Brown would have been on that team too.
Kevin Brown. So they had all kinds of guys that you're just like, God, these guys are amazing. So I thought a lot of more players actually would move on. It just goes to show you how tough it is to make the NHL.
All right, I just got a couple more. First of all, I just wanted to say that you mentioned his time in Oshawa before. I was honored to be part of Mark's jersey retirement in Oshawa. I did the MC for it. And the wild thing about that was the rug got a bit mucked up. Like there was a bit of a loop on the rug, so it was raised. And Mark's mother, when she walked out, she slipped and fell.
Oh.
Much to all of our horror. She's good, right?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. My mom's good.
You're good.
Yeah. But that helped me actually, because as we both know, I was there was a little water on the rug after my speech. I couldn't keep it together for much, but that helped my early start of my speech. I started off with, I see you all met my mother, so that worked out.
That's right. I remember that.
That worked out really well. So, but yeah, she's doing good.
And where do you keep your Stanley Cup ring?
My Stanley Cup ring is in a safe, locked away, and it's so ginormous that it's tough to wear. I've been asked to wear it to a couple weddings that I go to. I know I brought it down on the rink just for my kids' team that I'm coaching, just to show them once in a while when they need a little inspiration. But yeah, that's where it stays. It's in a safe, and I won't tell you the location of the safe, but it's in a safe.
Wise call.
That's a smart move. Just about everybody that's played with the Atlanta Thrashers has stories about the Atlanta Thrashers. Elliot and I work regularly with Colby Armstrong, and the Atlanta Thrashers stories are becoming legendary. Are there a couple of stories from your Thrashers days you can share with us? Because, you know, in a lot of ways, I know you had, you know, a 65-point season with Calgary before that, but that's when, you know, that elite-level playmaker, Mark Savard, really started to show himself. What are some of your memories from playing with the Thrashers, and can you share any stories?
Well, I'll start from day one when Bob Hartley took over the Thrashers. He was really a changing influence in my hockey career. He basically came in day one and had a meeting with me. I think it was his first meeting, and he pulled me in behind closed doors and he said, "Listen, Savvy," he said, "I know what you can do. I coached in Colorado against you when you were in Calgary. There's so much more here to give." He said, "I'm going to give you the opportunity. The ball's in your court." He said, "You're going to get ice time. There's going to be no complaints there, but you got to produce out there and do everything that I ask you to do, and you'll be fine." And, I mean, I owe a lot of what I have to Bob today. He was great for me. He put me through the ringer, but he was a great coach for me and great person. And, you know, I went through a tough time there in Atlanta, too, with the Healy-Schneider incident.
Yep.
And that was a life-changing experience, too. You know, it brought a lot of guys closer together. And it was a tough time for Danny, and I was able to help Danny. I roomed with him throughout that year when he came back. And it was tough. There was some tough nights for him, and I was glad to be there for him and work through it with him. So there was a lot of things. But it really was a fun place to play hockey, to be honest with you. I lived in Duluth, Georgia, where our practice rink was. I lived in Sugarloaf, what a fantastic gated community. Was able to meet Stuart Sink there, who helped me with my golf career.
Mm.
A tremendous friend. He was a huge fan, season ticket holder. He never missed a game. So we had a good relationship that way. I loved golf. He loved hockey. And the list goes on. It was a fantastic place to play. It's too bad that we didn't get too many viewers due to football and other circumstances, but it's something that I'll cherish again forever.
Any moments that leave you scratching your head from Atlanta? I mean, I can remember talking to Eli Gold, was the original play-by-play voice of the Birmingham Bulls.
I also did Alabama football.
Does NASCAR as well.
Yeah.
So this is when the Toronto Tourists, the WHA, goes to Birmingham to become the Bulls. So it's a brand new hockey market. And I said, Eli, what did the fans like the most? And I'm expecting it's WHA, so he's going to say, you know, the brawls and the long hair and the mustaches and the back-scratching slap shots and, you know, the rock and roll of hockey. And he said, what the fans loved were players that changed on the fly, especially wholesale changes. Five guys goes on, five guys go on, five guys go off, because they'd never seen that in any other sport. You don't do that in any other sport other than hockey. He said, we couldn't figure it out, that it'd be a wholesale line change and the place would erupt. Five guys come out and they're in perfect position. We couldn't figure this out because it was a new hockey market. Now, of course, Atlanta had the Flames previous, but were those moments where you said to yourself, okay, we need to teach the crowd here what hockey is all over again in Atlanta?
Oh, for sure. There were moments like that, but they got better. They got better, but they would still announce it during the play, like, you know, okay, this is an offside, when the whistle would go off, just to refresh some memories or an icing, or, you know, they'd seem baffled. Or anytime, I can remember clearly right now that when there was a penalty and the ref did his little sign, he would go up on the scoreboard and they'd tell you what the sign was. I got to know the signs really well, actually, because I was a little bit behind on the signs, too. No, it was great. And the rink there was just gorgeous. I mean, it was a gorgeous facility, if you guys can recall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it was
Phillips
great
was
rink.
Nice, yeah.
Great rink.
Listen, we're going to wrap on that. Mark, once again, congratulations on a wonderful career. Hope to have you back on the podcast. Best of luck in future endeavors, whether they be broadcasting, whether they be coaching. Let's just stay in touch. You're a big part of the NHL. And, you know, let me just end on this one. Because Elliot mentioned Eric Lindros a second ago, and that was in a lot of ways the touchstone in the beginning of serious conversations about concussions. When you look back on your career, I mean, you're a wonderful playmaker. The vision, I mean, just so gifted, Mark. But, you know, one of your legacies, sure you didn't want it this way, is going to be things like Rule 48 and, you know, the how you changed the way hitting happened in the NHL. Does that resonate with you?
It does. And, I mean, for my career anyway, it did, and there is something left behind, and it is a rule, unfortunately, but I'm glad that it's protecting players and their safety, and it seems like they've caught on more and more. It's gotten better, I believe, if you looked at the statistics on suspensions this year for headshots or blindsided hits. I would have to say, Elliot, you're a statistician. They have gone down, I'd imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And at least there's something left there, like you said. And if it's not my jersey in Oshawa, which I'm very proud of, and my kids are going to be able to see it every time they go down to Oshawa, which is incredible, it'll be Rule 48. So I'm, in a way, it's weird to say you're proud of that, but at least there's something there in my legacy for sure.
You know what? I got to tell you this. This might be the wrong thing to say. I don't like that. When I think of Mark Savard, I don't think of that. This is what I think of. I always love that story about your draft, how you stormed out and you turned it into motivation. But when the NHL All-Star game was in Ottawa, you played in that one, right, Mark? That was the All-Star game you were at?
I played in two All-Star games. I played in one in Montreal and one in Atlanta, actually.
Oh, okay, so maybe it was the one in Atlanta. But Kelly Rudy was part of the broadcast, and I'm down on the ice surface, and I've got my IFB in so I can hear what Kelly says. And Kelly says, here's Mark Savard, and they were about to do the passing competition. And he goes, in my opinion, Mark Savard throws the best saucer pass in the NHL. And that is the way I remember Mark Savard.
That's very nice, and thank you. And then it's funny, in that same All-Star game that you're talking about, I remember Marty Saint-Louis coming over to me, and I played with him in Calgary too, and he said to me, Savvy, like, every pass you make, does it have to be a saucer pass? I guess it's just something I enjoy doing, just saucing the puck. I guess some guys enjoy shooting it, and I enjoy saucing it.
And just to torture Calgary Flames fans here a little bit on the podcast, can you imagine, Mark, if Saint-Louis would have stayed with Calgary and you would have stayed with Calgary at the same time?
It's funny. We used to drive to the rink together. How's that, too? So
wow.
I used to pick him up every day. We lived right beside each other, drive to the rink together. We both be peed off that we're not playing, and we get to the rink and go home together, peed off again. So we end up doing okay, though, and Marty was a great guy. We had a lot of fun together.
And you can only make an effective sauce pass with a great tape job, right?
You need to have a great tape job, heel to toe. You got to get the whole heel and the toe in there so the puck slides off beautifully.
Heel to toe, gathers no snow. You're the best. Mark, thanks for spending time with us today. Much appreciated.
Okay, fellas, thanks for having me.
Hockey Central Saturday on the Sportsnet Radio Network. Tune in every Saturday starting at 5 p.m. for NHL game coverage on Sportsnet 590 The Fan.
I want to thank Mark Savard for dropping by the podcast. Officially our first guest on the 31 Thoughts podcast. So thanks to Mark Savard for that. I can see the guy coaching. I can see the guy in broadcasting. The nice thing about all of it is he wants to stay involved, Elliot, in some capacity.
You know, I'm happy he's happy. You know, Jeff, I have a six-year-old boy.
Yep.
And you have young kids too. And I had a long talk with a doctor about concussions. And his biggest concern is that families now see them as a death sentence, that there's so much negativity out there. And I'm not trying to say they aren't potentially bad. You've got to be smart with them. He says that now the word concussion, there's so many parents hear that with their kids and they think, oh, no, my kid's life is ruined. Or if you get one, oh, no, my life is ruined. That I watched Eric Lindros last week in Philadelphia. I heard Mark Savard on that phone call. I think it is important to know that if you tackle it properly, there is hope and you can live a good, happy life. And if there's one thing I hope everybody gets out of that podcast and that interview, it's that. I think it is very, very important. I think the reporting on concussions is important, but I also believe that we have gotten to a position where we have created this fear that might be too much.
How much of that is just because of the uncertainty about it as well? Like, there's been exponential growth when it comes to knowledge of concussions post-Eric Lindros.
But we're still in the infancy.
Well, but that's just it. Like, I don't know that we can really, because I think of it too, you know, the thought of, okay, because both my kids play hockey. Our seven-year-old plays at a pretty high level. And there are so many times where there's like big collisions, open ice, along the boards. It doesn't matter. And I say to myself, and our kids both played lacrosse, and they would get
tough sport.
Holy smoke. I'll tell you what, it helped hockey because it taught them how to keep their heads up when they go up and down the ice. But I always say to myself, like, man, if they're going to be playing these sports, and this is the reason I don't want my kids playing football. They can watch and can be a lot of fun, but I don't want them playing football. But I always say in the back of my mind, like, how will I react when my kid has, hopefully never happens, his first concussion.
Yeah, I understand.
And, you know, there's a school of thought out there about concussions, too, that with the amount of second-generation players, now more so than ever in the NHL, and, you know, a lot of GMs have kids that play at a high level, and power brokers in the NHL who have kids play at a high level, the sensitivity around concussions is heightened because now you have skin in the game because now it's your family.
Yeah.
Because now it's your children and it's not just someone else's kids and it's a tough sport and you make your own decision and you're a parent, you know, and people listening on the podcast right now are parents, they understand. It's your natural inclination to protect, to do whatever you can to create a safe environment for your children. I can't help but thinking that that is happening at the NHL level right now. Because whether it's, you know, Colin Campbell, had, you know, Gregory Campbell go through, a lot of general managers in the NHL have kids playing a higher level, and it is natural for you to try to create a safe environment for them. And I really believe that part of, and it's a good thing, part of the reason why there is a heightened sensitivity about concussions is because a lot of GMs and power brokers have kids in the game.
Well, that was the case with Ray Shiro for sure.
Yep.
His kid had a big concussion problem. There's no question about that. You know what's interesting now, and I found this in the playoffs last year, we would talk about guys who overcame injury to play, and I would get more tweets than ever about why are we celebrating this.
Really?
And I don't know what to make of that. You know, in some ways I understood, in some ways it bothered me.
Ooh, it's different for everyone because we do celebrate that. Oh, you know, he's you know, Paul Kariya rushes off the doctor's table before anyone can look at him to see if he's got a concussion to score against Martin Brodeur. What a hero. What a gladiator. What a warrior. We look back now and say, what are you thinking?
Well, it's always easier to do that with 20/20 hindsight. There's no question, yes. But still, there are guys who play and we wonder, like Cam Newton a couple weeks ago in the NFL.
Oh, that looked awful.
Yeah, you know, they got Gronkowski off the field last weekend. We'll be curious to see if he plays in the Super Bowl. But I can only judge things the way I would handle them myself, right? I know that if it was me and it was like a playoff game and it was something that really mattered to me, I would lie and I would play. 1,000 times out of 1,000.
Not even a playoff game, though. I remember the first
no,
time.
No, but this happened in the playoffs last year.
Yeah, yeah.
That's why I thought about it.
Well, we saw Jonathan Quick in Toronto when concussion spotters tried to get him off the ice.
Yes.
I can remember the Edmonton-Minnesota game where McDavid bumped his chin off
and
the ice.
And he was furious they took him off.
And he was livid, but so was Jonathan Quick. Like yeah. That's it. Like, to your point, players are angry when you force them to go get checked out. There are a few moments where I've really scratched my head, and I'm not sure that this shouldn't be industry standard. I can recall late last season, Montreal, Chicago, and Shea Weber tees one up. It's a one-timer from the top of the face-off circle, and it catches Corey Crawford between the lookers. And he goes down, Nestie plunge, and gets back up, and he finishes the period. And it was the third period, and the game was over. And I thought to myself, he just took like a 120-mile slap shot in the head from maybe, you know, the hardest shooter. Well, we've had tons.
Deneau.
We've had tons. I mean,
Girardi.
And for that, and this is for a bigger conversation when I get to some Twitter questions here. For everyone who talks about bigger nets, remember Larry Quinn had those nets, Buffalo, to
yes.
Lockout, and the big bubbles around them, and the nets were higher. The thinking is, if goaltenders are going down to seal up the bottom, you know, we're going to give shooters more space up high. I always say to myself, if you're going to make the nets bigger and you're going to make that leap, don't make them taller.
Yeah.
Make them wider. I don't want to encourage more players to be shooting high.
Yeah.
And we're seeing it every single week. Furk and Girardi was.
Ugh.
I watched it live and I was frightened.
Scary.
As soon as you see those legs wiggle, you know it's a bad scene.
All right, let's do some questions.
Let's do some questions here.
We're way long.
Hurry up. Sorry to bore you today. Although, you know what? You're getting in great shape if you take this podcast out for a run.
That's
today.
Right.
If
you can't finish running until the podcast is over, you're doing good.
Comes to us from Aiden James Marco, hashtag Ask31. Does Ottawa have a plan for the conditional first they have to give the Avs either this year or next? That's a big decision because
I think you wait to see where you end up in the lottery.
It could be worse next year.
Yes, I know.
And better chances.
You're waiting to see where you are in the lottery
and they
before
have,
you make that call.
Correct me if I'm wrong. They have right up until the final moment before the draft to surrender or keep that pick,
correct? It's late. It is definitely late.
From Jonathan C., if the Sedins want to return for one more year, will Vancouver take them?
Yes.
At one-year deals now?
They're yes.
Evergreen stage
of their
careers?
I think one-year deals, yeah.
From Ryan Rinney, what's the feeling with the other 30 teams about Vegas? Angry or embarrassed an expansion team is going to town on their teams, or happy they've brought in a new fan base, scared about the Seattle expansion draft?
I think they're jealous. They're jealous they get to live in Vegas. It's a great place to live. You know, it's not just the Strip. They're jealous of how well they're doing. I think it's complicated some other situations. I think owners look at that and say, why is their team good and this expansion team good and we're not?
Mm-hmm. Especially with our players.
I'll tell you what else it's done, and I did make a joke about it in my notes this week, is that it has increased the interest in the Seattle job when they get a team.
And what was the line that you got from someone in the NHL?
Whenever they win a game, five more people have applied for the Seattle GM job.
There's two tweets here.
I always laugh when he sends me that.
Ask 31, they're pretty. One of them is a legit question. There's a same question, but has a funny attachment to it. From Robert Tiffin, what more does John Klingberg need to do to win the Norris this year? Coupled with J. Jason Jeremy, who submits, will you give Klingberg the Norris if Stars fans agree to shut up about Zubov in the Hall?
Well, I'll put it this way. I won't shut up about that because I believe Sergei Zubov should be in the Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that Klingberg is yet considered enough of a two-way guy to be a Norris winner. I think he's in the conversation, but he's not winning it over Drew Doughty or those Nashville guys. You know, Subban's having a monster year.
Been amazing this year.
Like, I don't think he's going to win it over Subban. I don't think he's going to win it over Drew Doughty. I mean, who else do you want to put in this conversation?
I would have put Victor Hedman in it going away, but now he's down with the injury.
Well, it depends on how long he's out. Like, I don't see him winning it over Victor Hedman. I don't see that. I don't see him having the support yet to win over those guys.
Ask 31 is the hashtag, but I want to finish on one more thought from 31 Thoughts this week. The Professional Hockey Writers Association, fan balloting and mid-season awards. You want to break this one down quickly for our listeners?
Yeah, sure. We're doing, the Professional Hockey Writers Association is doing mid-season awards this year. They used to be done all the time, but they kind of went away, and now we've brought them back. And there's a couple reasons we're doing it. One, we think they're fun. Why not?
Sure.
Number two, we think it's a good idea to start thinking about the awards earlier in the year. If you do mid-season awards, you start to think, you know what? Who are some of the players I've got to start thinking about, like John Klingberg? And where do I rank them? And it gets these people on your radar. Number three, it makes you hate us. So that's why we're doing it. For example, in the year, we don't vote the Vezina. The GMs or vote the Vezina, but we put it here. This time, you know, we don't vote the Jack Adams. The Broadcasters Association votes the Jack Adams. We put it here. We added a couple fun ones like Comeback Player of the Year and the Rod Langway Defensive Defenseman Award, which Dallas Stars fans can put Esa Lindell in there if they'd like to. But one of the things we decided to do to make it different, and if you hate it, it was my idea, so you can blame me. The Heisman Trophy has 929 voters. There's about 870 voters. There's the 58 former Heisman winners who are alive, I believe, have a vote. They can vote. And they have one other vote, and that's a fan vote. So basically, there's a site where you can go to, and every fan can vote. And when they add up their votes, the number one person gets a first place vote. So it's enough that you feel that you're involved, but it doesn't allow you to stuff the ballot box. So we're doing the same thing with this, that all the fans are entitled to vote. And all of your votes will be tabulated, and depending on who gets what percentage, we're going to put them in. So you will have a part in the process. And you go to the Twitter, our Twitter site, which is at the PHWA, at the PHWA, and we want you to participate. We want to see what you have to say.
Can I float one out there?
Sure.
The Ron Francis Award.
For what?
Most assists.
A guy who has aged the least over 50 years.
Still looks good into his advanced years.
Yes.
No, they have the Rocket Richard Trophy for most goals. What about the Ron Francis Award for most assists?
Well, it's an easy one.
Pretty simple. Yeah, there's no voting.
It's not bad. I'm sure he'd be embarrassed by that. But you know what? He probably wouldn't like the attention. I think it's a great idea.
And on that, we'll wrap it up. Thanks. Well, a couple things we didn't get to. We'll pick it up next week about player
interviews. I would like to hear some feedback, Jeff. Like, I get concerned when this goes too long. There have been times over the years, remember when we worked at CBC, CBC wanted me to do 30 Thoughts in three parts. They had a consultant who said, that blog is too long.
Mm-hmm.
And 30 Thoughts, they came to me and they said, 30 Thoughts, we wanted to do one day is 1 to 10, the next day 11 to 20. I said, you know what, either you guys want it or you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Just tell me. And once I threw out a tweet, tell me if it's too long. And people overwhelmingly said no, which I really appreciated. I would like to know if they think this podcast is too long.
This is a long one today.
Yeah.
The sweet spot, we are told, is about 45 minutes. That's how much
your ears... And we're about 3 hours and 45 minutes today.
Ears can handle. So we will wrap it up. But yeah, send in thoughts on how long you think this thing should be, because we're throwing darts. I want to thank a number of people for the podcast today. As always, our producer, Emil Delich, Show Ali.
Who's not here. I don't know why we're thanking him.
Well, because he's going to piece it all together and make it sound real
nice. Okay,
By the time people listen to this, they'll be like, oh, yeah, we know why.
Victor back there.
And Show Ali.
Show Ali's back there. And is Brian still back there? We've got three guys back there. None of them named Emil who's taking credit for this show.
You know those podcasts where it just sounds like two guys talking and then the credits are at the end and there's like a dozen producers and you say, it took this many people to make this turkey? That's kind of like 31 Thoughts, the podcast. Thanks so much for downloading and allowing us into your ears wherever you take us. We certainly appreciate it. We thank you for the reviews and we thank you for the downloads and all the Twitter and Reddit love. Thank you so much. Back in 7 days. More 31 Thoughts, the podcast.